Hey, it's the next Landon Ramblecast. It's August 11th. It's 2026. It's Brad. It's Alex. It's Vinny. Alex is steepling his fingers.
I do that a lot. I don't know. What does that mean? Is that an unusual gesture for me doing this?
It's like you're waiting for something.
I'm just waiting for the show to start. You're ready to go. We started the show.
You're ready to go. You've got something in the chamber to say.
I mean, I do, but it's not pressing. It's not a thing we have to do right at the beginning here. It was just, you know, hey, we're back. Great. Mm-hmm, hey, yeah. You know, I my chin was tired, so I put my hands under it.
Well, now with all that preamble out of the way, now you have to say what it is.
All right, fine. Okay, so you have heard me talk about how water had been getting into my basement the last, like, week or so, right? Mm-hmm. I talked about this somewhere.
Mm-hmm.
I can't remember where.
Somewhere. Well, at least I knew about it.
Yeah, I think I talked, maybe it wasn't on the Ramblecast last week, but I might have talked about it on some streams and stuff. But so we were very worried that this meant that our water table was rising, that groundwater was coming up from the floor and all of that. And it was in a new spot. So it was all very terrifying.
Like in the middle of the room, right?
In the middle back of the room. Yeah, in the laundry room. And it was kind of extending into both the back room parts of the basement. Got it. Anyway, so we were very worried that this meant this was the moment where we were going to have to, like, basically do the drain and all the other shit, you know, spend the money to upend this basement and turn it into something that was a little more fortified. And I was coming to peace with that idea. I was almost ready to be like, you know what? Let's just fucking do it. Let's pull this Band-Aid off. Let's just make this happen. For a couple days, didn't get any water. And I was like, okay, you know, and then we had that big rain. And I was like, okay, so this is probably a couple days later. That's when it's all going to
come of big
flooding
rains.
In again. And it did.
Yes.
But I noticed something this time. And this is where I am going to emphasize right now. I truly am God's perfect idiot. So some weeks ago, my partner, in a very, like, pleasant gesture and in a good gesture, decided, hey, you should have a dehumidifier down here because it gets really humid in the laundry room in particular, especially when you're running the washing machine and everything, like a lot of water in that, or just feels humid in that room.
Okay.
So, and it's like, I was able to get this, like, kind of big one, not like industrial grade, but, like, you know, a bigger space one for relatively cheap. And I was like, great, that's awesome. Let's do it. And the thing she told me over and over again was that, you know, when the bucket fills, all you have to do is just pull it out, dump it in the sink, you're good, put it in. And I was doing that. It was working just fine. Fine. Okay. Yeah. But this time, when I noticed all the water in the basement, I noticed there was a trail coming from the dehumidifier that seemed to drift down toward where the water was pooling. And I was like, wait, that doesn't make any sense. It's supposed to shut off when you turn. So what I learned is that there's an alternate mode on this thing.
Yeah.
If you set it in such a way, it will. And if you plug in a tube like you're supposed it will drain the water automatically into a sink or a bucket or wherever it is you have it set up.
Or drainage,
yes. And the way we had set it initially was correct. It was doing what it was supposed to do. But then at some point, something got switched. And this is where my anger comes in.
Oh, okay. Yeah, get on it.
This is a tremendous device. It has done great work. It has pulled lots of water out of the atmosphere, and I'm very happy about it. But it has my one great bugaboo, my one absolute hated thing about modern technology, which is that it has no buttons. It has a touch interface on the top.
Oh.
And if you happen to brush the top interface on the top at the right angle, you might accidentally set that setting so that it starts shooting water into your fucking basement!
That's wild. So wait. There's no, okay, couple of questions. There's no cap over the hose?
Not
spigot?
By default.
Wait, really? Like it doesn't, where you'd put the hose on doesn't just have a cap over it?
Not by default.
So is it, when you say not by default, you have to get a cap or is it just
opened? I don't
know,
but there wasn't one on there when we pulled it out.
Okay.
And
wouldn't it probably leak water elsewhere, right? If the level got too high, it would just come out of all over, right?
You would think so, yeah.
Okay. I used to have mine set when I remember when my basement was just a God's forsaken land.
Mm-hmm. Those times. It was quite some time.
Yeah. And I used to just run mine like that with a hose that went into
the drainage.
If you'd like to call it drainage,
wherever it was draining to,
where no soul shall venture.
Yes.
So I used to run mine just like that, and now I have that one up here, and I have to run it with a bucket in the garage because And yeah, I'm just even trying to think. Mine has a cap so that water would fill the bucket, because it still would go into the bucket. The way mine functions is the way I think it should function. The water would fill the bucket, but the spigot would then come, I think, out of the bucket. And if the bucket filled, the float would go up. And that's what that, you know what I'm saying? Like if there was a blockage in the hose, it would turn off.
Yes.
I believe that's how mine works. I would have to double check it all. Maybe it's not, but some way I think it might not be on. Sorry, we're getting in the weeds here because now I'm actually thinking about how it would work. But I do think if the water were backing up, it would fill the bucket and the float would go up.
You would think so. Yes.
Yes.
So anyway, my point here is that this is a key design flaw. I feel like one, that there is no like perma cap on that thing, and two, that you can just brush the top interface and accidentally make it switch without realizing.
It feels like it should be like a hard toggle switch, like inside a panel.
Totally.
Or something.
Something physical. Yeah. So you solve the problem. Like end of the story though, is like you fix your water problem. Hopefully.
Seemingly. Yes. Okay. And so we did have to pull up some carpet in the corner. We had to do some drying of some, like, you know, floor area and carpet and whatnot, but that's almost, I think, clear at this point. I also sprayed some anti-mold stuff on there just to make sure that, you know, nothing caught in there. But basically, I think that it was a false alarm.
So this was the lone source of the water then?
Seemingly, yes.
Okay.
Hmm.
And I also know exactly where the slope in my laundry room floor is and how water might travel down should something else like that happen again.
Yeah, are basements built that way? Well, I guess it depends on the builder, right? Like do they build like a subtle grade into basements for purposes like this?
So sometimes they'll do it if there is floor drainage. Like if you have a straight up like drain in your floor, like, you know, you have like one of those old like coal sinks, coal showers or something like that. Sometimes you just want water to drain into the floor. I think this is more the result of the house very subtly sinking over its 90 years of existence. And so the floor probably has just started to grade slightly down. That's it.
I bet yours was built with a slope on it at some point. You might have had a coal room down there as well.
I don't think so. And the reason I don't think so is because why would it slope to the back wall?
Well, it could be. I don't know where your drainage is, but it could have been like mine definitely sloped into the drainage, right? Like it sloped.
But we don't have drainage.
But you might have previously had it down there.
Do you have a door into the basement? Oh wait, never mind. I'm sorry. My basement frame of reference is all like built into hills.
Oh yes.
Never mind. Like all the houses in our neighborhood back home have basements where like one corner of the house is exposed to the air.
Oh yeah.
Because houses are built into like significant slopes. You know what I mean? What I mean is I forget that most basements are just fully underground.
Yeah. I'm on a hill. I'm not built into a hill.
So your basement is finished. Parts of it are finished.
The majority of it is finished. Yeah. The laundry room is the only one part that isn't, but it has a solid concrete floor.
Yeah. Yeah. So somebody's done work. Our houses are old. We're about the same, I think. Mine's 1920s. Yours is around there.
Yeah. So mine is, I think it's 90 years old either this year or next year.
So I do wonder if at some point you had a coal room where somebody was shoveling coal into that basement, needed to access that basement for coal or oil heat. Which I suspect you do. You probably have gas now, right? Or
I'm almost positive it's gas. Yeah.
And I do wonder if at some point maybe the septic system was different, and maybe they changed it I mean that's the thing with old houses. Like there's the guts of it. I'm so glad this water thing wound up being a humidifier or like a source that you could fix so easily.
I just wanted to fucking torpedo myself out a window when I realized what this actually was relief, and what was happening. Though? I mean, yes, but also I feel like a moron.
Isn't it better than water coming from outside?
I know.
Yes. It is way less expensive. It is way less time consuming. It is way less destructive to my day-to-day routine. But at the same time, God damn it, I'm an idiot.
Yeah, but this in the end, it winds up being a good, good kind of.
And in a week or two, when I'm past this, I'm sure I will feel the ultimate relief from it. But right now, all I'm doing is just punching myself in the head going, what is wrong with you?
Now, I'm not saying you should do this, but there is a world where you could mount that dehumidifier up on a wall and have it drain into that sink forever.
Well, it's already doing that now. We put the hose in, and now it's just draining into the sink.
Wait, it has a pump in it?
Yeah, it so what that's what I'm saying is that what would happen normally in this mode is that you plug the hose into that little hole.
Yeah.
And then it will drain through that hose into wherever you want it to.
But your dehumidifier has like a built-in pump to pump the water up the hose?
I guess, because that water is pumping.
It is.
The sink. Yeah,
it is. Oh, that's awesome.
Well, let me put it this way. I haven't emptied it in 2 days, and there's no water on the floor, so I assume it's working.
Okay, great. Yeah. I don't think your dehumidifier can defy the laws of gravity. It must have a pump in it.
Do you ever find that like certain water behavior sort of goes counter to how you think reality should work? Like, I'm trying to think how to explain this. Like, there's situations where like water pressure makes water go up a pipe or up a tube, you know, that feels like, oh, the force of just gravity pushing on the water on the other end shouldn't be enough to push that water up through there. But apparently it is. But maybe
that's how your house water works.
Right. Yeah. Right. Like, it's all
pressure.
It seems like you need more pressure than like just what nature would provide to make that work. But I guess not.
I mean, look, as far as I understand it, first of all, with dehumidifiers, some do just have water or pumps built into them. And you could probably hear the pump go if you've ever been in the room and heard the water pump out.
I haven't heard it go yet, but I'm sure it's doing it.
Second, for home stuff, I do think they, at least in my town, they put the water under pressure before sending it through the system to homes. But then your household pressure can push it up small pipes, you know, to your showers and stuff.
Right.
But in apartment buildings, I do believe the water comes from the roof and then it comes down, and that's how they get pressure, not from the bottom up. I maybe it's all different, but in New York City, they'd have giant water towers top of buildings.
The buildings, I
even have this with like a Brita filter, though. You know what I mean? Like we have like one of the bigger like reservoir ones that go in the fridge.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
And it's like when it's like 3/4 full in the bottom and you pour a little bit in the top, it feels like the water on the top should just sit. Well, it feels like it should just sit there because it's like surely that little bit of extra water shouldn't be enough to be able to push down or, you know, to.
Yeah, yeah. It does go slower, though, doesn't it?
Yeah, I guess it does. Yeah, but it still does. Anyway, I don't know. Maybe this
sometimes
is like
I lift mine up to make it go faster when I want more water.
Maybe I'm really just getting at like water displacement, like the buoyancy of ships kind of thing is such
water
a weird
is
thing.
Weird.
It's a weird
it's
thing
weird.
To wrap your head around. It's like to float this size of ship made out of this material, you need to displace this much water. And I think the way you're supposed to visualize it is like like a ship staying afloat is because technically like the water to the sides of it is like you can visualize the water to the sides like trying to rush in and fill the space that's being
like
displaced by
up,
the ship. And that's why that's why it stays afloat is because the water around it is constantly trying to get under it. Basically, I think it's how that works.
It has a raft work.
Let's ask James Cameron.
yes, you should not be able to put a million ton steel thing in water and have it float. It ain't natural. It's like putting a plane in the air.
Mm-hmm.
That's great. Alex, you have to send me a link to your dehumidifier at some point. I'd love to know which one you got.
What kind do you have?
Oh, I don't know.
what are you rocking down there?
Sam bought it, so I don't actually even know what kind it is. I'm sure it's just some random brand, but
I think ours is a Frigidaire, and it's been going for like a decade without, I don't know if we've ever even like replaced the filter on it.
Is that in your apartment?
Yeah.
Okay, and you have the bucket?
Yeah, not an external bucket. It's like an internal reservoir.
You have to empty it. In San Francisco, how often are you emptying that thing? It's like once a day?
It depends on time of year.
Okay.
Leave it on all the time, though, because it's, you know, it uses a fair amount of electricity and is loud, and also in a space this small, it heats the apartment up pretty significantly.
Yes.
Because it's just pumping hot air out, or not hot, but, you know, it's pumping fairly warm air out constantly, so we use it kind of as needed. We have... What's the term? Hygrometer, I think, is the thing that shows humidity is the right term. We have like 5 of those all over the house because there's fog and everything. Like, we ended up having like a mildew issue at one point.
Yeah.
Like some chairs we have in the walk-in closet stored in there and some of my old video game stuff all had mildew on it. And that was not cool.
We're in a space now talking about this, but it's a weird thing. They say, because I've also had mildew problems as well, under 60% humidity, relative humidity.
Yeah, yeah, that's always been... I shoot for 50. I always feel like 50 is the good comfortable spot, but that's
hard
to get to.
I set mine to 50. Yeah. Because I think that's where I'm comfortable. But I think 60 is for health reasons where they say to do it. But I don't know. Like you grew up more down south. Jersey is like basically a swamp now. Like,
yeah.
Like, what is it? What does that mean? How do you live?
So there are three, one of them's broken now, but there were three dehumidifiers downstairs in the basement back home. until one of them were all running all day long, and you just had to go down there, and they never got around to building central drainage in, because it would have required like a lot of piping, because where the moisture comes in is not near where the drainage is.
But I just feel like I can't open a window all summer here now.
So you're just having to go down there like twice a day and empty all the dehumidifiers.
And they're basically air conditioners, the way they work. They're you know, mm-hmm. they can suck up a lot of.
Oh, you mean in terms of like there's a compressor in there and it's condensing and it's moisture,
coolant, and you know the way that works. Yeah. I mean, you want to look at weird stuff. If you ever look up how an air conditioner or dehumidifier work, the way it pressurizes the coolant and then it takes in energy, releases energy, and how that whole thing works is a really weird process. But yeah, they're just basically like little air conditioners.
Right. And also with the way water and moisture and air works and stuff, you could justify running the AC more so you can run your dehumidifier less.
So
because the cooler the air, the less you need the dehumidifier.
So I went through some of this recently and thinking about, should I get a whole home dehumidifier? We just had a friend, Alex knows this person too, who was just dealing with some in-house moisture problems. And, and I was like, man, our house here gets really humid when it rains and if we open the window or something. I was like, should I get a whole house dehumidifier so I don't run the air conditioner because we have central air? Could I put it on the line to take the humidity out without doing the air conditioner work? Would it make any difference? I don't know. They're so similar. I don't know. I did not. I spent a little time looking at it and being like, is this something I could do myself? I don't feel like having somebody come in and do this kind of work. Or I could just shut the windows. And what I do is I just put the air conditioner down a tick, like 1 degree down, to have it run for a little bit. And usually that sucks all the humidity out. Because my wife, who is a lovely person, will be like, because look, I get it. She wants fresh air in the house. She just doesn't want the whole house closed up with the AC running all the time. And she's like, we shouldn't run the AC. And so it'll rain outside. And she'll be like, look, it's cooling off. Let's open the windows. It's raining. And I'm like, no. It's really humid outside. It's going to be so humid in here. It's going to be gross. She's like, it's so cool outside. Like, no. Like, relative humidity, you're not getting it. It's raining. It's definitely 100% humidity outside. There's rain coming down. Even if it feels cooler, when that moist, cool air comes in, it's going to be in here. And so there's just been, I feel like once or twice a year, I have to be like, go ahead, open the window. Not like a jerk, but I will be like, open the windows. And we'll open the windows. And then within like an hour, it's like the paper starts getting damp in the house and all like, I'm like, we can't, we got to close it up.
Got to touch the stove occasionally.
Just be like, look, I understand it just feels so nice and cool out there because of the rain, but once it gets in here, it's not going to be good. You're not going to love it.
That is the constant struggle around here. The constant cycle is clammy. Too humid. Yeah. Turn on the dehumidifier. It finally gets kind of somewhat dry in here, but now it's like 75. It's unpleasant in here. Yeah. And now I'm going to crack a window to let some cool air in, and now it's moist again. Like it's just,
The constant battle against Carl.
Yeah.
And water.
Mm-hmm.
They should just make a weather that's normal.
It's just that entropy again.
And there is, Alex, here, it's called the 2 days in fall that we get, that are like 60 and dry. And we're like,
yay. The 3.5 days of autumn we get at all are definitely that. But
Very nice.
Anyway, so basement drier, I guess, is how I would end that.
That seems like a victory.
Yeah, that sounds like great one to me. If anybody has any tips and lives in the Northeast or in California, let us know, because with all the climate change stuff going on now, not only in the United States, but all over the world, I feel like everybody's just trying to figure it out.
Oh,
everybody's like, how do we upend centuries of the way we built houses and dwellings?
Bad. It's getting bad. This is grim. I saw a headline yesterday that extreme temperatures in, I don't know what part of the world this is. I didn't look closely enough. It's wherever camels live, because the headline was about extreme heat is starting to exceed the level that camels can survive.
Jeez.
Yeah.
The Sahara.
And camels can really survive a lot.
Right.
Yeah.
They're built for it.
This is embarrassing, but hang on. I need to look up a Fahrenheit to Celsius calculator or converter.
Just guess.
I'm trying to remember. I think they said, okay, yes. So it was like 50 Celsius, I think, is the 45 to 50 is
that
where
it's very hot.
So 50,
I mean, humans already definitely can't live at those temperatures generally.
Yeah, 50 Celsius is 122 Fahrenheit, like 45 is 113. So we're talking about like those ranges, but basically they like have done some like research, biological research on camels and like what the extreme heat effects are on them. And like it's getting to the point now where they like, it is like slowly starting to defeat their evolved defenses against extreme heat. It's like
they need a third hump.
If even the camels can't handle it, like what are we doing?
Yeah.
Yeah. And you know, it's a thing that I think affects, again, one of those things that aside from the extinction level events, just we have a lot of architecture that is built in a certain way for a climate, right? Like houses in certain areas don't have central air, or they're built, you know, to be of their climate. And now as that all shifts a grade up, people are like, what the hell, man? Like, it ain't supposed to be this hot here. We never built these things for to be cool, or, you know, certain houses were built to channel hot air certain ways, and we didn't do that over here. And in Jersey, I think one of the problems with the older houses is like we never had to deal with this much water. Like, it just,
yeah,
it just comes down in buckets. We're getting flooding a lot of places in New Jersey that the system can't handle, the septic systems can't handle, and it's just rivers around streets and stuff will just happen.
Yeah, like every time it rains here, it is a full-on river down the hill on my street every single time now. And it's like every once in a while you get a nice gentle rain, but generally speaking, it's like torrential downpour for 20 straight minutes. Okay, we're done. Bye. You know, and it's just
it's rain like I've never
constant.
You guys really are just getting the weather patterns migrating up the coast then, because that is the classic. That is the classic summer behavior back home in the summer. Is like
this was Williamsburg weather too.
Not every afternoon, but pretty, you know, several times a week in the summer, it's just like, well, here is the 12 or 1 o'clock thunderstorm right on cue. Like, it just the sky darkens and it pours buckets and thunders and lightnings. And like I used to go out and play in it as I would get yelled at a lot for being outside in a thunderstorm.
Yeah.
But so we used to have sun showers, and they were like gentle. Being like kind of gentle. It's weird. It was sunny and then a cloud rolled over and we got some sprinkling.
This is ridiculous. Like the reason I would go out and play in it is because in the sloped driveway with the kind of gutters, like it was just, we had like sort of a ditch like built into the asphalt, I guess.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I would just go out in barefoot and like splash around in the river running down the ditch on the side of the driveway.
Oh, God.
Cause it just poured rain for like 20 minutes. I mean, it happened when I was there.
I'm having a very clear and beautiful vision of you as a child barefoot in slow motion.
It was fun.
The happiest times of my life.
It was fun.
Just dancing in the rain and somebody going, Bradley, come inside. Just, I'm coming.
Yeah. There are a lot of, there's so many trees around there. I was not the tallest thing in the area. It was probably going to be fine.
But we have these, growing up on the East Coast, don't remember these things happening with this kind of frequency, but yes, it is. For about 10 to 15, maybe 20 minutes, it is like the skies open. And it's hard to describe just how much water pours out and just how not prepared a lot of the infrastructure is here for that much water that quickly. It's a weird thing, you know, and that's one aspect combined with a lot of other things. All of Europe obviously having to deal with what's happening there and places that...
it's everywhere. I mean, there's nowhere that isn't dealing with this on some level. And, you know, as much as I complain about my, you know, the wetness around here and the problems, like right now, these are problems that can be surmounted, you know, like for my house, if I ever and that's kind of what this process did for me, is that I'm now in the mental place of like, hey, if this actually does become a problem in the future, I am no longer going to freak out about it. I am ready for it whenever it happens.
You're girded.
Yeah. I mean, I'm not ready for it in the sense that if it starts happening, I'm still going to get water in the basement. I'm still going to have to hire someone to do all the work. But it is work that can fix it. It is not a problem that it's not like wildfires just being out of control in an entire region. You know, it's water is a thing you can at least temporarily solve.
Temporarily.
Yeah. So, you know, I'm ready for it if it comes, but I also know that at some point it is definitely going to do that.
Yeah. Yeah. And then, look, this is what makes me so mad about them not pushing for solar credits anymore for at least a lot of this areas, because I do feel like that is going to try for folks that can do it. And I think it should be adopted more by apartments and stuff like that. for the energy costs that are going to be incurred as people get more cooling, right? Like mm-hmm. it is just, you know, the solution to a lot of this stuff, the easier solution is air conditioning versus, you know, re-architecting an entire house to be or apartment building. But that's going to put such a strain on all the energy grids across the world.
Very hard. Mm-hmm.
That renewables could try and offset some of that. Anyway.
God, yeah. Could you see a future where, like, people have to get solar or some equivalent, like, local generation just to help handle the load of what they need for cooling to offset the climate change?
Well, so, I think we're already starting to trend in that direction. And then the data centers are now coming along and being like, well, what if we gobbled that up instead? God.
So I think about, like, Bacalar, who has a great roof and his head's all the way up. He's got a fantastic roof that faces the right direction. I ask for it because I'm living through vicariously through him sometimes his energy bill, and he still runs negative. And he's like, yeah, the air conditioner runs. I charge the car and he generates enough to offset that cost. Right. So that's like a kind of a cool little environment where he has, I mean, with the solar generating enough energy to keep that whole system going, which is the RTS dream, yeah, right? You want to, I mean, your resources are managing your production.
I just came off of paying the power bill for this past month that we were gone basically the entire month. And it was sobering to see what that it running? Was like, what do you mean?
Oh, like the dehumidifier, like when you said, well, you were not in the apartment.
In the other direction, it was sobering how cheap it was.
Oh, when you weren't there.
It was sobering to see how cheap it was, to see how much we're paying for, like, what we must be just using day to day and not the things that are just, like, plugged in when we're not here.
Yeah. Right. The idle.
It was like well under half of what the power bill normally is.
Oh, man.
So there's just there's a lot of money going into, like, computers and stuff that are running around here all day long.
Yes. Energy costs, not great, and not a great way necessarily to offset the global. Hey, are people still like, it's not, there is no climate change happening? Or is the argument just shifted to it's not man-made? Or is the argument shifted to, well, now what?
There's still a fair amount of it's not man-made.
Okay.
I don't think you see, I mean, some people are in just full-on denial of reality mode, as you know, and the people they are speaking to will believe anything they say. Mm-hmm. So there's still some of that. Oh, it's all a bunch of bullshit.
Okay, it's big industry, big energy, and
Or, you know, whatever the excuse is. Like, oh, it's not real. But I think, like, most people can believe most people can see the reality in front of their faces. So it's starting to shift more to, oh, climate cycles are normal. This is not man-made. But eventually it's just going to get to, like, well, this is happening, and to deal with it, we need to deal with the wrong people. You know who I mean? Like, that's where it's going to shift to, unfortunately.
Well, we should switch gears.
Yeah, anyway, that's dark.
Yeah, yes.
That's dark. You know what else uses a lot of energy?
Computers, video games.
An arcade CRT monitor?
They sure do.
Yes.
But boy howdy, that's where we should be putting our resources.
That's right. Yes, something everybody can believe in. I went to my first California Extreme this weekend.
Speaking of extremes.
This is where I was most of the weekend.
That's so cool. It's very air conditioned in that building.
Yeah, it was not bad. Yeah. I expected it to be hotter in there for how many monitors and people were in there.
It's a big space if it's still the same space.
My understanding, it's still in the Hyatt Regency in Santa Clara. CAX, California Extreme longtime Giant Bomb fans extremely know this because you guys were all going and, like, doing videos about it 15 years ago. I don't know how I have never gone to this thing.
I don't know either.
Other than I think I just was not really in a retro mode when you guys were going. Like, it was not far enough removed from that stuff, or I had just not hit my midlife crisis yet enough to care about old arcade games. But now I'm extremely in that mode. It's still in the Hyatt Regency in Santa Clara.
Okay.
I think it is still mainly the same ballroom. Although, was it two rooms when you went? Because it is two rooms now. Okay. Yeah.
It's probably
the same two rooms, I have to assume.
Okay.
I'll probably save some of the specific video game talk for the actual podcast this week, because it's, hey man, retro video games are also video games.
It's true.
You can cover those, but there's plenty of other stuff to talk about there.
I want to hear all about it.
I'm trying to think where to draw the line and what to talk about there. I got some, there's a lot of CRT stuff to talk about.
Okay, I think this is the place for some of that.
Do you want to talk about CRTs? Because I have multiple angles from which to approach.
Yes, give me some CRT talk. So cathode ray tube, give me the current state, and current concerns of the CRT community.
In fact, like nobody is more tuned into the specifics and high-level theory and R&D of CRTs than the arcade collecting community.
I believe it.
Because they need monitors to make those things keep going, and most of those monitors are 30 to 40 years old now.
Yes. Mm-hmm. And in some cases, there just is no digital substitute. The way the thing was programmed was for the way phosphorus lights up.
It was, let's see, I'm trying to think. There was one NARC machine there running on an LCD. That's the only cabinet I can remember there that was not using a CRT. I feel bad saying this. I kind of kept giving it the side eye every time I walked by it. I did not play that NARC machine.
Okay.
It's fine. If you want to put an LCD in your arcade cabinet, that's totally fine. It's up to you. But
Of course. I mean, and again, given the scarcity, B, the maintenance, and C, just the weight.
Yeah,
and,
yeah, totally. You know, they're heavy. On the flip side, I played a Ms. Pac-Man that our good friend of the show, Steve Lin. I went by myself on Caltrain, but Steve was there. Also a friend of the show, Wes Fenland, was there. So hung out with him a bit. But Steve is very plugged into, I know this is turning into a Steve Lin fan cast for very good reason.
It's worth it, yeah.
But he's very, you know, he brought like three machines himself. He's very tied into that community of collectors. So I was just able to get a lot of fun context and facts and stuff from him. There was one Ms. Pac-Man there that was using a brand new monitor.
Wait,
like,
what does that mean?
Like new old stock, like the owner of the machine had been able to source, I guess, like a new monitor. Ooh. That had never been used before. New, again, new old, like made back in the day, but like it was basically brand new in terms of condition and runtime.
Yeah, so was it new old stock for the arcade scene, or was it plucked from somewhere else?
I didn't ask, but I guess that's the case, or who knows actually at this point. In fact, I'll get to that, because the really interesting thing here is the work being done to start broadening the types of screens you can use in these things.
Okay.
But I'll get to that in a minute. But that was a really good looking Ms. Pac-Man machine. But I contrast that with there are plenty of machines around there that look like they're probably still using the original monitors, like very dim or yellowed or fuzzy.
Yeah.
All of the above. Yeah. For sure. A lot of field repairs going on.
Yeah.
Like a lot. Now, you've been to that thing. I'm sure you know how it is, but there's like very common to walk around and just see a machine pulled out with the back open, or like a board hanging out, or especially like the pinball tables. Like I was very excited that there was a Strider cabinet there, but the poor Strider cabinet was dark all weekend. And Steve said it might have been the neck board on the CRT that broke, and that's not getting fixed in the field. Like you're replacing the monitor at that point. So there were definitely a couple of machines here and there that were just not on at all weekend because something catastrophic happened that needs more repair.
Now, the neck board being the thing as the tube narrows into the gun, it's the board on the back of that?
You know more about it than I do, probably. I think that's right.
Okay. I'm not sure. I just assume. Just from the name
neck board. Might be in the area of the yoke.
Okay, by the yoke.
I went to a talk that I'll get into in a minute.
Okay.
But hang on, let me Google this other guy real fast. I want to make sure that he's cool. I mean, he was very cool in person, but...
Bunch of neck boards, you know?
That's right. Yes. Okay.
Grognards and neck boards.
This guy I met, there was a guy there running a CRT. I guess he I don't know if this, I assume is his day job, but he basically like repairs and deals in CRTs. He was very friendly and very knowledgeable, and he had like a stack, like a whole shelf full of CRTs behind him that he was selling for $200 to $300 a piece. And by the time I found him, they had all sold. He sold every single CRT he brought.
Hot dang. Yeah. I mean, look, this is where you go, right?
And this is also where I can see like just being a gregarious person is good for business, you know, because he was like very friendly and like, you know, approachable. But I went and talked to him, and like he was well acquainted with this Trinitron I found on the sidewalk.
The model.
I started reciting the model number, and he like finished it for me, and he's like, "Oh, great TV. I've sold two of them this year. How many times is it flashing?"
Oh,
like he knew.
And did he know what the problem was?
And I told him, I was like, it's flashing four times. It's the service manual says it's the A board. And he basically told me like three different things to try. He was like, I've had luck reseating the cable to that board. Sometimes that fixes it. And then he was like, okay, and if that doesn't work, then maybe look at replacing the capacitors around the chip that the manual says is the problem. Okay. And if that doesn't work, you might need to replace the actual chip. So,
or just get the board if you can.
Yeah, but I there are none. There are none of that board available right now that we could find.
Is the chip still made?
I haven't checked, but it sounds like every time I've asked anybody that knows, they say like, "Oh yeah, those are out there. Like you can still, you can still get stuff like
that." Okay.
So anyway, nice to have like a roadmap to
how to
fix that TV potentially.
I have a very, if you don't know the answer to this, it's fine. We don't have to go down this road, but do you know, is it a through hole pin chip? Is it a surface mount chip?
I'm sure I could find a,
is it balls?
I don't know. This was 99. This was before BGA. It was before the ball grid array became a thing.
Okay. Okay. Because
that was like mid 2000s and this is a 99 set. So,
okay. But you do think it's not seated in something. You can't just pop it out with a chip.
Oh, definitely not. I'm sure it's soldered on that board. So.
Okay.
And that is soldering work that is definitely beyond me. So, but he spoke very highly of the TV and like made it
awesome.
He made me feel like it would be worth doing the work to get it working.
Yeah. Yeah.
Cool.
I wonder if at some point, if you're not comfortable with it or get to a point where you're like, I want to fix this. I'm not going to invest the money to get the tools. I need to do this. I wonder if you can take the board out and send it to somebody and have them just redo it. I bet that exists as a service.
I wonder how well they'd be able to not troubleshoot it, but like check the repair work without the rest of the TV there to test it with though.
If they have a spare one.
You could test continuity. Sure. I mean,
yeah.
I was trying to find this guy. His business is called Dad's Garage, but there's a bunch of other
SEO on that's not super.
It's not easy to hang on. Let me Dad's Garage CRT. Here he is. Dad'sGarage.tv on Instagram is his account. He's in the East Bay. He's around here actually. So if it really came down to it, I could probably go out there.
Yeah.
But that gets into the territory of how much do I want to sink into getting this thing working? I don't know.
That chip is probably only a couple of bucks.
And I mean, it would be a great learning experience, but also the scope creep on something like this is terrifying if you're a certain kind of person. Cause like, I think, did you link this in the Discord, the discharge tool you built that you talked about on here last week? Was that on Discord? You linked the YouTube?
Yeah, I put it in there. Yeah. Yeah.
So I started watching that and then I was like, oh, before I discharge my first ever CRT, maybe I should build one. You know what I mean?
It's like a cool tool to build.
It's idiotic when you can get a $5 rubber handled screwdriver and do the same thing, you know, but then I'm like, oh, maybe I should build this tool for this thing I'm likely to do like twice in my life.
So look, I think that's a thing where like one of the fun parts is building the tool.
Yeah, right.
Like if you're like, hey, this is a fun thing. Some of the pieces for that, it's an inexpensive thing to build, the one I linked. But, you know, you wind up doing a DigiKey order and then you're like, well, I'm doing this.
Totally.
This thing is $5, but maybe I should get some other stuff while I'm here. And like, oh, a chip puller. I always you know, should get one of those. Justify the shipping on this. And
that is totally the underlying actual reason to get this TV working is how much I would hopefully learn along the way and like the sense of accomplishment. And just it's just something to do, you know, like it's just something to occupy your time for a while because I've got this lovely little 14-inch CRT behind me. If I just.
Yes.
It's more about getting a thing working and cleaning it up. And,
totally. Something that was in the trash.
Right. And
now it works.
And picking up some skills, you know, just the whole thing. But
just for anybody curious before they're like, why wouldn't you just use a rubber handed screwdriver? The one that I followed, the one that I built from the YouTube video, it's a basically a resistor that hooks up into your multimeter so you can watch the capacitance go down as it's discharging into the resistor.
It's like a peace of mind. You can see by the numbers where it's at and you know it's safe.
Yeah. And you basically just hook up the probes to it and then you are watching that there's no capacitance or voltage in it. But the reason I wound up building it is I was working on some audio gear and I thought they had discharged and I left them long enough to discharge after I turned it off and I was sliding a board across my bench and it must have rolled over a piece of metal that shorted it and it just popped.
Oof.
Like a big old pop. And I was like, okay, I need to really verify that I have discharged all of these capacitors.
Maybe electricity was a mistake.
That's great.
Something that you can't see and can kill you is maybe...
It was a pretty big pop and nothing welded together, but it definitely was a sign that... you know, it's one of those things.
Yeah, like
More you do it, the more comfortable you get, and you're just like, oh, this is like the eighth time I'm powering this on and off. And I will say the other thing that if you're gonna build that tool, Brad, the other cheap thing I think that is worth investing in before you keep turning that TV on and off is a dim bulb. Have you ever heard of this? It's you basically put, this is more for audio equipment, but it might work for TV stuff. If there's a short, it's going to draw a ton of amps, right? If something's shorting, it's going to draw as much as it can before it pops a breaker or something melts, right? It's just going to keep drawing electricity. So a dim bulb, we basically put an old filament light bulb in line with the power, and it'll go super bright if there's a short, right?
Oh, interesting. Okay.
And so you immediately turn it off until the bulb goes bright and then settles back down, because that means it drew and then it's fine. And it were just, but if it stays super bright, it acts as a resistor in line, but you can see it glowing super bright, and it's discharging a lot of the extra voltage let's just say wattage that's coming through. So when the bulb is super, so if you have an unknown piece of gear, usually plug it into this dim bulb circuit and you turn it on. And if the bulb goes super bright and stays bright, you immediately turn it off, because you know that shit is broken before it melts or something else happens. It's saved my butt a couple of times.
These safety mechanisms are appealing to me, because I know that I am the kind of cut corners, impatient, can get careless type that I'm a little skittish about, or even knowing that you need to discharge and to be careful and stuff. I'm still a little worried at some point about sticking my hand on something.
The stuff you're dealing with, TVs, old amplifiers, that stuff can be pretty gnarly.
It's frightening. Like I read the iFixit guide for discharging a CRT after we talked about this last week. And like they mentioned the thing of like, make sure you put your other hand behind your back when you're doing this, just in case, because you don't want this current running through your heart and killing you.
Yeah,
and that whole thing—it's a lot, but I'm not gonna do it without somebody learned around to supervise for sure.
It's not something to be taken lightly. Yeah. But you know, it's I think that stuff is awesome when something comes back to life.
So here is the real shit. Like, this is speaking of bringing things back to life, and you may have heard this before. I've definitely talked about this before. I met this guy before, but this was a big update after it's been a couple of years. The open source CRT guy was there.
Oh, wow. Okay.
The project is called TD-CRT. TD-CRT is the name of the GitHub repo. TD is just his name, Thomas Davey.
Okay.
And I think we keep referring to it as the open source CRT, but what it really is an open plan for CRT chassis.
Okay, so that's the thing that would control the gun?
So it is, yes. So effectively, if you open up an old TV or an old CRT, it's like the tube itself, the screen, the tube is the screen.
Yeah.
And it's like a vacuum inside and I definitely can't speak to the full operation of how these things work, although that's 80% of what this talk was, which was extremely over my head. But
I mean, it's a vacuum tube, but the inside, I think, usually coated in phosphor or something, something else that illuminates when it's hit with electrons.
Right. Yes. It's all electricity. It's all electrons all the way down.
As far as I understand it.
Right. And he got into I'll get into it later, but what the chassis is everything outside of that tube. It's all the electronics, the circuit boards and power regulators and everything else that hooks up to a tube.
Yeah.
To make it go.
Yeah. It's a thing that feels like it's going to snap off when you look at it. It's like dangling there.
Right. So he's been working for like 8 years to basically design a system that can throw out all those old electronics. So you have nothing but the tube original, and he's got a modern design that will work. When he gets there, and he's almost there, it's getting really close from the sound of it, maybe a couple more years, it'll work with any tube on the planet, basically.
So it's basically it's basically in concept, not in practice. Well, FPGA for CRTs. It kind of mimics the...
There's no FPGA on there. It's all...
A version of the same concept,
it's trying to emulate
It's a modern implementation of, all modern parts. And so Will and I met this guy at the Vintage Computer Festival 2 years ago. He showed a version of this in 2024 and talked to him there.
Yeah. But
I wanted to go to this talk to see where things were at and also try to get a better understanding of just how the whole thing works. And again, he spent most of this talk just talking about how a CRT works.
That's fascinating, because they are wild.
It was really interesting, but also it was so many electrical formulas and circuit diagrams, and like he put up like numerous waveforms, and just like it was just way past me for the most part.
Yeah.
But he was peppering tons of comments about his project in there along the way, and it's gotten significantly better since 2024. He put up a timeline of like, okay, 2018 was the first one I built that worked.
Yeah.
2021, I did this. 2024, VCF. And he showed a picture of the thing I saw at VCF 2 years ago. It's gotten smaller since then. He's reduced it into a smaller board even in the last 2 years. And he went through all this stuff about, like, he went through his philosophy of how to spec it out, basically. And, like, the number one priority is sustainability in terms of the parts you need. Because you can't be building a thing where there's a limited supply of some chips you need, and those are all going to run out in 2 years. This needs to be something that's going to last kind of forever. Also, I got the sense that maybe arcade is his actual first love, or that's like, that might have been the genesis of this project, is that he seems like he really cares about arcade games. Like he said, he had, when this thing was fairly far along, he went to Japan at one point and hung out with a friend who lives over there that owns some Japanese arcade cabinets over there, and they basically like pulled one of his cabinets apart to test this thing.
Like, it's, yeah, I mean, that's the limiting factor, right? It's the CRTs are really the bottleneck on a lot of these repairs.
And so, but this is going to be applicable to anything that uses a CRT, but it seems like arcades are maybe the thing he cares about preserving the most. But so it needs to be something that's going to keep these machines going for decades. So he's building it around parts that have to be modern.
Like generic enough?
Generic, modern, and widely available enough that anybody will be able to do this. And so it was like, it got really interesting where he was talking about, like, you know, there's a huge amount of current going through these things. You know what a MOSFET is. I don't know what a MOSFET does, but
it's a transistor, but it's field effect transistor.
Okay.
It's different than a bipolar transistor.
Yeah. So he had mentioned this at the VCF.
Very sensitive to static electricity.
Yeah. And sorry, this is getting very technical, and this is stuff I barely understand or don't in a lot of cases, but he's using these new type, silicon carbide MOSFETs.
Oh,
that apparently can handle like huge amounts of currents.
Okay.
Because a lot of the, especially like vector monitors, like a lot of these old monitors, I mean, this is like frightening amounts of electricity.
Got a ray gun basically in there, blasting electrons at a your screen.
I gather this is kind of like how gallium nitride has gotten big in like phone chargers, you know, like all the power bricks you're buying, the USB-C power bricks you're getting on Amazon are all GaN gallium nitride now because they can handle way more power than the materials that were used.
Oh, I had no
20,
idea.
30 years ago. So it's that kind of thing where it's just like, better materials science has come along in the last 20 or 30 years that has just enabled things to get smaller and like cooler and maybe hopefully cheaper eventually than we had the science to do decades ago.
Right.
And these silicon carbide MOSFETs are a big part of that, where it's like he discovered these things halfway through this project and they have enabled him to make this thing much smaller and cooler. Cool. But he was saying like when he first found them, they were $90 a piece.
Okay.
And now they're down to $7 a piece. So that's kind of an example of like there's cool new tech out there that's slowly getting cheaper that's making this sort of thing possible. He had a new demo unit set up there in a little cabinet with a clear back so you could see what the setup looks like. And it's like three little circuit boards. It's not a big deal at this point. And the last slide of his presentation was, can I buy it? Like, that's the question. Everybody's just like, hey, can I get this thing yet? And he said he's getting there. Like, the plans are up now on GitHub. Like, if you want to
you can
get
try
your
and
own,
manufacture your own.
If you want to get your own boards made, you could make this now.
But does it work?
Yeah, 100%. Like, he had a little cabinet there running. I forget what. I took a video.
Does it work
of it.
With a lot of. So, like, how does it work?
Yes, it works. So, that I guess I'm kind of burying the lead other than that I mentioned this briefly. But what this is going to enable you to do, this was his goal all along, is, you know, I'm trying to fix this TV I found on the sidewalk. And the problem with that TV is in the electronics, it's not the tube. So, in the future, when this thing is more accessible to more people, you would get one of these tubes like I found and just rip all the old electronics out and just install one of these instead and it would just work and you wouldn't even have to bother troubleshooting. Because he was talking about like every manufacturer and then every model that manufacturer made, all those old sets have their own failure modes that each have to be diagnosed individually.
Yeah.
Like you know, it's a huge amount of research per model just to figure out what's wrong with your thing. But if this is a universal design, then theoretically you just need one set of documentation for this thing. And the ultimate goal is, he basically was like, and again, this is for like arcade operators. He was like, I want you to be able to just go down to Goodwill or the e-waste facility and just grab any tube that looks good.
Yeah.
Out of before it gets destroyed.
Before it's smashed.
Or for $20. And especially for arcade games that use weird resolutions or weird sync rates or frame rates or whatever, because that stuff's all over the place in arcade cabinets. This thing will be able to drive all of those on like any tube, basically. So it's going to hugely broaden the pool of available tubes that people can just grab and hook this thing up to and use in, as an arcade monitor or a TV or a PC monitor or anything.
So, okay, I have a lot of questions, but my biggest burning question is it software based?
So there
based
is
on the
some,
model of Tube?
Yes. So, I think that stuff's universal. So he built an app.
Okay.
This thing, or maybe it's not an app. I don't know if it's a web interface or how you access it. But even I think at the VCF 2 years ago, he was driving this off an iPad. But okay. I think it's a serial connection. There's some kind of data connection to this thing. And it is all software configurable. All the resolution, the sync rate, all the parameters
okay.
for how you run a CRT in specific ways are controlled through software now, as
but
opposed
it must,
to.
Oh, man.
Like he said, you know, like I could, in fact, I think it does have a few knobs for some of these basic settings as well. If you just want to reach in there and like tweak knobs, but it's got a software interface to drive like everything, all the parameters of
okay.
how the CRT.
So it's got some
displays.
Kind of microcontroller in there or something.
Yes,
that
there is, I found this Googling it a week or two ago before I went to this thing on some electronics forum of people like kind of throwing shade at this thing because like he is using software to drive certain parts of what normally would be done in hardware on a classic CRT. And there were some mm-hmm. people sort of like looking down their nose at this. There's like, oh, there's no way a software controller is going to be able to hit the precision necessary to do this blah, 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 horizontal sync, something that I didn't understand, you know, but.
Well, that's what I was wondering is like, you know, there's different sweeps of this gun for different monitors.
Yeah.
I assume like even the 27 inch versus a 13 inch, the gun has to sweep, but I assume a different, how would it know unless you're putting in the dimensions and the type of, yeah. I mean, all of that stuff. That's fascinating.
Yeah. But there were like three different points in his presentation where he talked about some chip on this thing where he's like, I'm working on sourcing a better version of this. Or
okay.
like I'm waiting for this to happen. Or like, you know, he's constantly looking for parts to improve before he gets to the full-on final design to
yeah.
make things better. But like,
what a cool thing.
I took my glasses down so I could see really up close and got like 3 inches from the screen on the demo unit he had running, and like
yeah.
it looked just as good as any classic manufactured CRT that you could think of. Like I'd say even in the state it's in, it's absolutely fine for normal people. If there's anything different, I certainly couldn't see it.
So if this thing comes to fruition in a mass market, or a, you know, quote unquote mass market, meaning
as mass market
is hundreds
like
of
gets.
People who might want one.
Yeah.
Did anything at California Extreme from anyone ever talk about a new manufacturer of tubes?
No, he fielded a question in the talk about that, and like somebody basically asked, like, is there any chance manufacturing yeah. is ever going to start back up? And he said, absolutely not.
No.
The last factory that was making new CRTs, he talked about it. It shut down in 2015.
Yeah.
It was in India.
Okay.
And even there, they were melting down old tubes to reclaim the materials to make new tubes out of. Like,
okay.
It was already that hanging by a thread at that point,
okay.
10 plus years ago before. And even that shut down. He was just like, there is absolutely no chance anybody's ever going to do this. Like, it's too many, hard to source and hazardous materials.
Yeah.
It's just too much expense. It's too hard and difficult and expensive.
Like, it's not even a thing that like some, you know,
boutique
oriented billionaire could just
yeah.
open their own little factory and be like, I mean, you could do it, but like it's such an obnoxious thing to have to try and spin up in that way.
I guess never say never. I mean, now that we've said this, like somebody's gonna find a way to do it in their backyard or something, but for now it seems basically not. But with something like, that's the cool thing about this is that there are still bajillion CRTs just sitting around out there.
Yeah.
The problem, like I said, was if
the
electronics fail far before the CR, the
yeah.
tube goes
yeah.
bad. And so having a turnkey way to just replace all the electronics
yeah.
and be able to drive whatever signal you want to it. And so I tracked him down after this thing and asked him, I was like, all right, I'm like generously like intermediate technical compared to this guy. I mean, this guy is like utterly brilliant listening to mm-hmm. him talk about this stuff. It's just insane the level of expertise here. But I was just like, I basically asked, like, is this going to get turnkey enough by the time it's for sale or by the time it's like a tidy little kit you can
yeah.
get
mm-hmm.
that normal people could install it? And he said, yeah, I think so. Like, if you're, you know, I basically was like, if you're able to like discharge a CRT, like, do you think a person who can't do much beyond that could install this? And he basically said, like, yeah, I think so, because like the connection to the tube is quite straightforward. There's really not a lot to hook up
just
there.
Like two or three wires.
The one thing he said, though, is that every model of tube is going to require a custom wiring harness.
Yeah.
But those are shared between, like, it really depends on who made, like, which company made certain parts of the interface to the tube. So I assume, like, that'll all get documented. There'll be, like, a community
yeah.
wiki where they publish plans for every type of wiring harness you might need, and you'll just, like, match it to the one you have and buy the right one and you're probably good. But anyway, this thing is like super exciting for keeping the thing I keep saying is this strikes me as like a thing that could keep CRTs working past the point anybody is alive who cares about CRTs.
I mean, CRTs will fade over time and you know, you will have degradation, I think, of the physical tube, but for somebody who sees something on the street, I guess the question would be then at the price point, and it sounds like he's trying to work this out to where it is viable, is like, if you found a free TV, what's the cost of getting that harness, or what's the cost of getting this kit to salvaging that TV, right? If you find a free TV, are you going to spend $50 or $75 to bring it back to life? Or was your break point free? You know,
right,
like,
right.
Were you at the point where you're like, no, it was free or nothing. I'm not going to go spend
$100
or whatever the kit might be. You know?
So there's a couple things there. First of all, he said the bill of materials for this thing currently is about $300. So it's not cheap. But also he said at the top, like he said explicitly, like, I did not optimize for cost on this thing. I optimized for sustainability and availability of parts and quality first. Basically, because he was like, if you're already an arcade collector, you're already insane. Like, you're already, you've committed to spending large amounts of money on your hobby. So, like, it will get cheaper, but he's mainly making sure that it's something that can last and be available.
Right.
So who knows how cheap it'll ever get. But the other thing is, like, I feel like kind of an idiot for, I'm not going to say I've fully become a CRT guy overnight, but I'm kind of like inclining in that direction right now. Uh-huh. At exactly the moment that the options for getting that look on modern TVs have never ever been better and continue to improve rapidly. You know what I mean? Like,
The filters, like
I get it. Yeah.
Like the retro tinks, like the FPGAs have been a huge boon for making, for processing video signals and making them look like CRTs. And so stuff like the retro tinks out there are just almost as good at this point. Like, we're getting very close to, you can get the look of a CRT on a modern TV very well at this point.
I mean, like we said, there are some things that functionally, mechanically do need a CRT.
Yeah.
Yes.
But I will say, if I were to, and this is a project I'd love to do in the future once my basement is done, do a freestanding or similar built into a wall type MAME cabinet or something like that, I'd put an LCD in there. I don't think I'd put a CRT in there. I just think it's the maintenance on it, and I think the filters look fine. And I think I'd also want to run more modern stuff in 16:9 on the cabinet. So I would probably just do a 16:9 LCD that then does borders for 4x3. I think while I love the look of an old CRT, and I have one here and I have one in my jazz machine, if I were building a cabinet to play everything, I would probably put something that is an LCD with 16:9, because I do think the retro tink filters look pretty good if you want them. The variety of stuff that you can do, like spinning a CRT to be 3x4, if you're doing rotating those versus rotating an LCD screen, is a big difference.
Very big difference.
What if you just had a permanent Tate CRT on the side?
One could. I think that preservation is awesome. I'm also interested, if that thing does come out, I wonder if you'll see the secondhand market balloon up on like eBay or something like that, where it's like, you know, suddenly CRTs are hitting the market. And I wonder if that would drive costs up or down, you know?
It's hard to say. I mean, I could see like pre-made kits of this with tubes being sold, and I guarantee that'll happen. And in addition to like just the kit itself, you can install.
No housing or...
But on the other hand, like I said, it's gonna make so many more tubes, like CRTs, without the electronic. Yeah, it's gonna make so many more of those useful that would not have been previously, that it could also hopefully depress the costs of,
that'd be
of
nice.
That stuff. Because like I said, working sets are, you know, like that guy was selling these for $200-$300 a pop, and he sold everyone he brought on day one.
And when he was selling them, he wasn't just selling the tube; he was selling the whole chassis.
They were original models. Like, they were all like Sonys and JVCs
So if you had to buy that tube and a $300 kit ish, let's say maybe it gets a little cheaper. It's for the enthusiast.
Yeah, or you know, people that just want the exact look. You know, like the modern solutions aren't quite there. They're getting much closer. Like the final frontier is the motion clarity. Like the modern flat screens just have so much more motion blur.
Yes.
Like you lose a ton of detail when things are moving, and they're getting into places now where like they can simulate that, but you need an LCD that can do like 500 hertz or something. You know, you need like extremely high refresh screens to be able to get around that problem. But those are starting to be made and become cheaper. So like I bet 10 years from now, like you can just get the exact look of a CRT. Like mathematically, it's going to be almost exactly the same.
Yeah, but there's still, are they figuring out stuff that like works with the way interlacing works on like doing some effects? The one I always think about is like Sonic in the waterfall, right? Like where you know, he just blinks on modern versus having that kind of dithered effect.
I think they're getting there.
Okay,
I'm not an expert, but I think so.
But we won't get what are they called? What are the ones that are just the bright lines like asteroids? The vector games.
That's a whole other, apparently.
Yeah, that feels like a whole different ball game.
Apparently, I didn't realize this. Apparently, vector monitors use like an insane amount of electricity.
It's so cool.
I believe it.
I have a story about that I'll save for the regular podcast because it's about playing a game. But I'm actually not sure if this thing works with vector monitors. I think it does currently. I'm not sure, but yeah. That's a whole other thing.
If I were to build something in my basement, I also just kind of, for me, feel like I would want to save the CRT for a dedicated cabinet versus a MAME or FPGA thing that is going to run through that I'm going to play 5 seconds of a game on and then move on. Like if I were to build like a dedicated Street Fighter cabinet, I would put it in there. And that's like, hey, I know what I'm always going to want. It's just going to be this forever. So I think they both have their uses, you know, and I think restoration is probably where I would push the CRTs towards versus emulation and FPGA. Yeah, sure. I would say, hey, you know, unless you're being like, I always play stuff from before 1992, right? And it's always going to be on here.
Yeah.
If you're listening to this podcast and you are the person who has my old Sony monitor that said you were going to put in a DDR machine, I would love to know.
That's fun.
You remember that giant thing, right? We've talked about this before. Like 300 pounds.
The one we moved.
Yeah.
That one time.
Yeah.
Yes.
And they were just so excited. They said they were going to put in a DDR cabinet. And I wonder if that's still
that's awesome.
In there.
Yeah. Somebody in the East Bay is giving away one of those right now.
I mean, you cannot give them away because they're so heavy.
It's crazy though, because most of the CRTs, like I said, are being priced at insane amounts. Like people want like $150 for like an 8-inch JVC with a VCR, but you know what I mean? Like these little TVs, people are trying to get $200 for. So I kind of sort of can't, this is like a 32 or a 36 inch. It's like it's one of the last HD CRTs that Sony made.
Yeah.
And in the East Bay, and they were just giving it away. And I thought about renting a car and going and getting it, but then
so heavy.
There's that, and also these are from after they would take the signal from classic consoles. Like this is like a 1080i set only, 540 and 1080 only.
Yeah,
meaning it has to run old consoles converter through a scaler, and that adds latency, so that's kind of pointless for old games.
Great monitor though.
But it's just out there in the East Bay. If somebody wants to Facebook Marketplace,
contrast, fantastic.
That's right.
Do you motion. Still have your plasma TV?
No, you got rid of that a while ago, didn't you?
No.
Wait, I thought you got rid of that thing a while ago.
All right, we got a bunch of stuff.
We can't see it on camera, Brad. You can fake this if you really want to.
The CRT from the sidewalk CRT is pushed up against the back of the plasma right now.
Okay.
Brad, becoming the dad's garage. You are going to just open up a shop.
It's hard to do that in an apartment, though, bro.
Harder, yes.
I have the plasma because it has similar advantages to a CRT, though. So now that I've got these, it's maybe easier to let the plasma go at this point. Anyway, we should wrap this up. The last thing I'll say real quick, because I don't know if I'll talk about this on the main podcast, is it was fun playing like non-video and non-pinball stuff there.
Oh, like the physical games?
There was a lot more, like electrical, electromechanical or physical. Like I played skee ball for the first time in like 35 years, and that was a lot of fun.
They have the one there that, I forget what it's called. Everybody loves it. It's the one where the platform, it's got like multiple little ledges and they tilt and you have to get the ball in
Fire Escape. So that was there. That is Steve's. That's one of the three machines.
Oh, hell yeah.
I wanted to play it, but he wasn't nearby and I couldn't figure out how to start a game on it.
Okay.
Or it may have been having an issue. I'm not sure because it was off and on.
That's a fun game.
But I wanted to play that one hopefully next year. But
okay. It's his personal one?
Yeah, that's his
machine. Oh, that's very cool.
We played this thing called Billy Ball, which is from Japan from the late 90s, which is basically playing pool, or sorry, it's like bowling with pool. It's like, it's the rules of bowling, but you are shooting billiards with a pool cue.
Huh. Is it like a big table?
It's huge. It is huge. And Billy it's very ball. Slow. It takes forever to re-rack the balls between shots, but basically it's like nine ball. It's like racking, it's racking them up like nine ball.
Okay.
And you're basically, all you're doing is just breaking over and over, trying to get every ball in the back like they're bowling pins.
Huh. Okay.
And if you leave it, so you're basically like trying to knock down a spare by playing pool. If you can envision this.
Yes, I can.
It's a little hard. I might look it up after. Billy Ball?
Like, yeah, it's very obscure. I don't know how many they made. Like, I think a lot of people were not even aware of it before it showed up here.
Yeah, bless the people who truck those things over there.
Moving that machine must not have been fun. Moving none of this stuff would be fun, but this one was just weird enough. I played a lot of pool in college, and I was like, yeah, man, we would have played a lot of this if this had been in the dive bar.
Interesting.
It's because it's... Like I got like three strikes in a row at the end, and it was quite fun.
Did they have anybody have that vertical pinball arcade cabinet hybrid thing? It's like it uses mirrors, I think. Oh. And like you like push a pinball up a screen, but it uses mirrors, so it's like a flat. It's a weird.
That's possible.
It was one of those, those types of things that are just like these weirdo mechanical machines are so weird.
I went mostly for the video games, and then kind of warmed up to the pinball, but especially like all these weird little side games. Yeah. I just kind of had a lot of fun checking
like
out.
Like Frankenstein, like somebody's dream meets reality.
I didn't see this, but I heard about it after the fact. There was this like head-to-head simultaneous pinball game that it was like a sit-down cocktail type configuration, but it was like... It was one long pinball play field, but each half of it was devoted to one of the players facing each other.
Oh, wow.
And you're both playing pinball at the same time.
Okay.
And you can basically like interfere with the other player's ball and like send stuff into their play area.
That's pretty wild.
It just sounded really wild. I'm going to have to look for that next year. But anyway, California Extreme is pretty neat.
Extreme.
Yep.
Once a year?
And pretty extreme. Yes. It's around this time every year in Santa Clara.
Did you see commerce taking place on cabinets that stuff say sold with a little sticker next to it?
Yeah, okay. Like every cabinet has a for sale or not for sale tag on it, so you know if you can.
What were the prices like?
Most of them just said for sale. Like
because
they had the name of the owner was on there, so you could inquire. Some of them were for trade, I want to say, or I know some swapping happens at this thing.
Okay, yeah.
I'm trying to think. There was a Guns N' Roses pinball table that I want to say it was the original, because there's a recent one apparently as well. Yes. Pinball is huge now.
Maybe I remember the old one too.
Yeah, we'll get into this, I guess, on the main podcast. Like pinball, I mean, you know this. Pinball is like kind of effing huge again. So there's like a recent Guns N' Roses one, but this is the one from like 92. I want to say they wanted $7,900 for it.
Okay. That doesn't sound out of the realm.
That sounds high, but not crazy.
I think these days that's like fairly standard. I think that's definitely up quite a bit from.
I mean, that's like where I think a new pinball table might be. This is a backlog question.
Yes, absolutely. Because they had both versions of the new Transformers when they included the deluxe one is like five figures.
What did you think of it? Did you look at it?
Fun.
What's up
fun.
With that Optimus Prime, man?
I played it.
You just hit him in the shins.
So you need to play. Yeah, yes. Yes, I absolutely saw and engaged in the hit Optimus in the shins.
He doesn't transform. But he looks like he should transform.
So the deluxe one that costs well into five figures has a lot of...
gimmicks?
Well, a lot of the figures that are static on the regular table like are mechanical and like do
the
things.
The Megatron or Soundwave. Yeah.
Yes. So, anyway.
But he still doesn't transform.
No, I know. That's a lot. That's a lot to ask, probably.
I'm so glad you had a fun time, though. What a fun show.
It was a nice diversion.
Yes.
Nice to get out of the house a little bit. All right. Let's
just
wrap one last it up thing there. Alex,
if you wanted to learn about Billy Ball, you will have to do a little digging, because unfortunately, famed baseball manager Billy Martin's autobiography is called Billy Ball.
Okay.
And that is the first thing that comes up, basically, in any permutation of Billy Ball you look for.
Oh,
great.
No.
Billy Hang Ball. On.
It's okay. Billy Martin's not that problematic. So if you end up with his book, it's not the end of the world, but still.
If you Google Billy Ball Bowling Arcade Japan, you will get some stuff.
Okay. Okay. I'll have to refine my search.
Let me see if please tell me I can at least find a picture of this thing, so I know I'm not insane. Did I just hallucinate the whole thing?
Found it. I found a picture of someone playing it on Flickr. So there you go.
Man. Yeah. I'll have to get that link from you. I can't even find a picture of this thing.
Wow.
That's intense. There's some really obscure stuff at this thing.
It looks like someone also has a video up of someone playing it at California Extreme like 2 years ago.
Okay, that would be the thing to look at for sure. Anyway, let's end the Ramblecast there.
Yeah.
Shall we?
Yes. Yeah, we got we're continuing our watch cast with Star Trek.
Continues.
Yeah, Star Trek continues and will continue until October, where we switch over to the horrors of film.
There will probably be another break in there somewhere, but yeah, Star Trek will be the theme until we hit the horror theme.
We got I think we're planning for today maybe roping in Brad on the raft to just check out our raft before maybe we pull the plug on the sink the raft, or we'll see what happens. We'll put it aside for a bit, but
I'm sorry, I have to jump in here. Yeah. It was a long weekend. I have not like sleep wise recovered just yet. It's Billy Bowl.
Billy Bowl. Okay.
Now it's my turn to feel like an idiot. It's Billy Bowl, not Billy Ball. Which
Billy Bowl.
You will definitely find it when you Google the right name.
Yes, I see it now. Yes, I look. All of three people were yelling at the podcast. They're like, yeah. "It's Billy Bowl."
Yeah. Well, I'm the actual idiot because I was the one staring at a picture of it being played, and I didn't register that it was called Billy Bowl instead of Billy Ball. So that's also on me.
This looks like a nightmare to maintain.
Yeah, I'm sure.
It looks like people would rip up that felt constantly.
Also, it is constantly playing the same four bars of this lounge music over and over and over. It never stops.
So it's like Discord waiting room music.
It does have a crowd applause that it plays when you get a strike.
Fantastic.
Which is cool.
Billy Bowl.
Bowl.
If you're looking for it. Raft.
Yes.
And then for the Tuesday stream, gosh, the name of the game escapes me, so I'm not going to spend the time to go over it. But Clue Crewin is the
some kind of mystery.
Hope. Yes, the mystery from the Rootrees people. I'm kind of excited to go into that. And then we'll be TBD for this Friday, but there's plenty of stuff for us to TBD about. So we're kind of weighing some options for that. Yeah, we'll have the podcast this week as we get closer to the September apocalypse for games.
Yep.
Yeah, unless you're arcaded out already, I'll talk about some of the actual games that I played at CAX on the main show. There is some interesting stuff there to discuss.
I like
some kind of rare stuff that showed up that people were not expecting or didn't know existed in one case.
Hell yeah. Come check that out. I've been playing some of that Iron Nest, that turret game. We're talking about that on the podcast. It's a weird one. As we get closer again to September. And Marvel.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Marvel.
Yes.
The Tokon. We'll talk about some of that. Hey, maybe we'll do a grab bag this Friday. You know, there might be enough stuff. We'll see. I like sometimes just keeping it open as we figure out exactly what's the best fit for Friday. So stay tuned for that.
Yeah.
Brad, you take us out of here?
That's right. I will take us out of here. I'm taking us out of here. The podcast is over. Thanks, everybody, for listening. We'll see you next week.